what fascinating stories there were in the life of the stagecoach, and in the lives of its courageous passengers who found romance in danger and understanding in strange companionships. From the adventures of these American frontier characters, John Ford has created a truly great motion picture, Stagecoach. A drama as forceful and as true as The Informer, and as gripping as The Hurricane.
You didn't answer what I asked you last night.
Look, kid, why don't you try to escape?
I gotta go to Lordsburg. Why don't you go to my ranch and wait for me?
Wait for a dead man.
It's ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez.
I'm Drea Clark.
And I'm Samantha Ellis.
It is so weird to have all three of us that we literally didn't know how to do an intro with three people on it.
We're all just rushing to the mic. Who's the Diana Ross? How do we get this started?
Well, in this case, it would be who's the John Wayne? Who's the Claire Trevor?
Very fair.
We're talking about 1939 Stagecoach in honor of John Wayne's birthday, as well as John Wayne in general and his very complicated legacy as a person. How has everybody been? Drea, explain where you've been all this time, because we have missed you.
Aw, I missed you guys. I was actually in Arkansas for the very first time. I've programmed the Bentonville Film Festival for 4 years now, which is Gina Davis's fest. That she started to really kind of focus on films by and featuring women and people of color. After 4 years of curating it, I finally was able to go down this year and spent the whole time, like literally all I saw of Arkansas was the tiny airport I flew into, the hotel, and then the theater that I lived at for like 12 hours a day. And I just moderated screenings, doing a ton of Q&As with filmmakers. But it was so lovely. It's really cool to see how a different part of the country takes in and interacts with film. You sort of take it for granted. Like, I've lived in LA for almost 20 years now, and I'm originally from the Midwest, so I know those places, but it was really cool being in a new state and watching them experience these films and get to interact with filmmakers. It was great. But yes, that's where I was, and now I'm back in sunny California.
Talking about a Western that was shot in sunny Southern California, I'm assuming.
Yes. Well, actually, there's a lot of Monument Valley. There's a lot of really recognizable Utah landscape. I do like to add that in a very funny way, because John Wayne was also from the Midwest, born in Iowa, but then raised in Glendale, California. So he has about as much of the natural Western connections as I do. And it makes me happy to know that.
It's so funny. I forget exactly what building near where I live. I, oddly enough, live near Burbank, Glendale, right there. And there is a building I know that has a giant statue of John Wayne on a horse in front of it. If anybody remembers a couple months ago when that Playboy interview that resurfaced that John Wayne did in the 70s came back out, and there was talk about renaming the Orange County Airport, John Wayne Airport, I had to laugh and be like, well, obviously the statue out front is not going away anytime soon.
That interview was not a great look for him.
We are going to be talking about that, because we are not just honoring the man, but how we approach old Hollywood in the midst of cancel culture. How do you approach an actor who had very different opinions than what is now acceptable? Or was it ever acceptable, depending on what they were saying? What's everybody's background with John Wayne prior to us talking about this movie and him as a person?
He was one of my dad's favorite actors. My dad's favorite movie is True Grit. And I feel like he is sort of that guy. He's everyone's dad's favorite actor. He was the epitome of masculinity. And so because of that, it doesn't really surprise me too much that he had those sorts of views. He was just really a conservative, masculine guy as a whole. And I hate to stereotype him, but he fits very well into that sort of stereotype. I haven't seen too many of his movies. I've seen really all of The Essentials, and that's about it. I only saw The Searchers for the first time last year. My approach to him has been a little bit slow because I haven't been a fan of the movies that he makes. It's not necessarily not being a fan of his. I haven't been a Western fan until very recently, but now that I am a Western fan and have grown to appreciate Westerns, I've looked at him through a new lens, especially with this movie.
Well, it's interesting you brought up your dad as the gateway, because that's very similar to my experience with John Wayne. My dad loves John Wayne, which probably explains a lot about my dad as a human being. As a teenage girl who had a very contentious relationship with her father, I avoided John Wayne movies because I was just like, I don't want to deal with anything that has my dad associated with it. So it wasn't really until I was a late teenage, early adulthood that I finally started to watch his movies. And oddly enough, I watched the movies that weren't what my dad really liked. So my dad is a big fan of like True Grit, late 50s John Wayne, early 60s stuff. I've seen those movies, and you're totally right that he is indicative of an era that really by the 50s and 60s had just ended already. This whole Manifest Destiny, reclaiming the Wild West, had really diminished by the time John Wayne was making these movies, but there was a nostalgia and a hominess to them that was entertaining. Even stuff that he did that was not Western related. I've seen The High and the Mighty, if anybody's seen that, where he's, you know, Captain John Wayne flying an airplane. There is this idea of masculinity as being very old school. That roguish cowboy who's able to take a woman over his knee and spank her. That says a lot about, I think, a generation of men. And so as an adult, now that I'm looking at what I know about John Wayne, I recommend everybody go read Scott Eyman's book, John Wayne, The Life and Legend, which is probably one of the best biographies I've ever read. And oddly enough, it's about an actor I didn't really care for, but the way that Eyman looks at him as a persona, as a human, warts and all, it's really fascinating because John Wayne was so desperate to perpetuate this idea of masculinity in the Old West being enticing that when he eventually got lung cancer, it really devastated him because he didn't know how he could be John Wayne if he was sick and if he was perceived as weak. And I think that's really sad and fascinating at the same time that even he bought into that persona of what John Wayne is. John Wayne now is like, I don't even know if it's a stereotype. I almost want to say it's a stereotype because now he's so ubiquitous, not as a person, but as a mentality, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, he's an archetype.
Yes, thank you. That's what I was going for.
What's funny about us all bringing up our dads is I texted mine yesterday to say that we were discussing this because I loved Westerns when I was a teenager. I do not know why, but it was probably entirely dependent on what the TV programming was over the weekends when I was a teenager, but I remember watching a ton of them. Ironically, The High and the Mighty, which is not a Western, but the one that Kristen just mentioned, might be one of the first movies I saw by him because I remember of him as an aviator, like a pilot, before I became so entrenched in the Western side of things. I love The Searchers and I love The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I have a lot of problems with John Ford too. So it's one of those as I've grown and become aware of the larger world, but there was something about Western storytelling that made a lot of sense to me. So when I texted my dad yesterday and said, we're talking about Stagecoach and that it's even better than I remembered, he wrote back, yeah, at the time it looked like John Wayne might actually become an actor, which I thought was great because I'm excited to get into it with Stagecoach because he is younger. It was a breakthrough performance for him. And seeing him so young and rangy, it's a pretty progressive movie, especially he's so famously passed on other films because he thought of them as either un-American or not holding up to this very specific macho American male ideal and how limiting that actually ultimately was as an artist. And even like Kristen said, like as a human, what is it when you've literally structured your life to maintain a very specific persona, how does that falseness eventually become a limitation? I loved my dad's snarky comment, but that's what the Clarks are known for. It seemed fitting.
That actually is such a good point, because part of my recent dive into Westerns and growing to appreciate them, it's really undeniable that the Western genre is one of the only 100% through and through American genres there are in cinema. And it's been an existing genre for over 100 years. As a film historian, it's really difficult to ignore that genre if you really want to learn about American history and American history in cinema.
If you watch Stagecoach and then you watch any of John Wayne's later movies once he had become a star, you realize how much this movie sticks out. Even though John Wayne has the quintessential star intro in this movie, it's really an ensemble piece. The views on women and religion and society as a whole is very different from how John Wayne's characters would approach women and society, religion, and different cultures in something like The Searchers. We almost did The Searchers because I know that's a more iconic choice than Stagecoach, but at the same time, The Searchers really, really makes me mad as a movie. And I didn't want to be angry. I wanted to talk about a movie that didn't hurt my heart. Have we all seen The Searchers?
I have, yeah. I don't mind The Searchers. I think I specifically watched it at the time for Natalie Wood. Like I said, I only discovered it last year for the first time. But I was so glad when we chose Stagecoach for multiple reasons. The number one reason being I had never seen anything so early of John Wayne's work by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, I grew up with The True Grits and The Searchers and Hatari as well, really 50s and 60s kind of work. And I have to admit, I'm not really attracted to older John Wayne, but I've seen gifs and pictures of him in Stagecoach forever, how really sexy he was, even when I'm not super into macho guys like that. I knew that I had to cross this movie off at some point, and this gave me the perfect opportunity. So I'm really glad we chose this one instead of The Searchers.
The Searchers is one of those, I have a really complicated, I appreciate it as a piece of cinema, and I understand why it's so popular, but it's just so racist. So racist.
As someone who just said how much they like The Searchers, I will absolutely back that up with someone who liked The Searchers so much years ago, before she started framing film in a larger context. It's horrifying. And there's things in Stagecoach I'm happy for us to be able to take on as well. Westerns in general did not do right by the Native American populace. And it's crazy watching the progression of that and how easily embraced a complete villainization, if that's a word, of an entire group of people was just like matter-of-factly taken in by moviegoers. It's obscene.
Absolutely. And it sort of makes me wonder now whether the villainization of Native Americans is entirely due to their portrayal in film, or sometimes you watch these movies and genuinely believe, were they really like that? Oh my gosh, are there actually violent tribes back then? There's no real way of knowing through film, because that's the only way that they're portrayed.
There were violent tribes that were as violent as the U.S. government cavalries that were going after them. It's horrifying. If you look back at any American history, this is going off the rails, but if you look into just even how we're taught about westward expansion or interactions with Native Americans. And like I said, I'm from Minnesota, which was heavily populated by the Sioux and other tribes. It was never taught to us. It was always like, oh, they just casually left, so our state didn't have any negativity. That all happened somewhere else. That's a whole other thing. But how the movies affect how people see things is very real. It's why film criticism on a mass commercial level is so important, because it's not just contextualizing the story and how did someone fall in love. It's reminding people this is how our culture's shaped. This is how we're keeping track of things.
That segues us nicely to Stagecoach, because for a movie that starts out with them talking about Geronimo is coming and he's going to destroy this town with his evil Native American ways, this movie is not really about them. It's more about white society as a whole. If you don't know, Stagecoach is from 1939. It's directed by John Ford. It tells the story of a group of people traveling on a stagecoach, who end up having to deal with the fact that they are different people on different journeys in life, all on their way to a town called Lordsburg. There is so much symbolism in this movie. Oh my gosh. You not only have John Wayne as Ringo, you have Claire Trevor as the unspoken prostitute. We're never really sure if she's a prostitute or if the uptight ladies of the, what do they call them?
It's like the Law and Order League.
Yes, I don't know if they just assume she's a prostitute. Claire Trevor plays Dallas. You have John Carradine, who plays the smooth-talking Southern Confederate-loving dude, Hatfield. Thomas Mitchell plays our formerly drunken doctor, Doc Boone. Louise Platt, who plays the model of Christian virginity, Miss Lucy Mallory, who is pregnant and at a certain point has a baby.
Excuse me, it's Mrs. She would never.
She would have never, exactly. Donald Meek, who lives up to his name, playing Samuel Peacock. You have a bunch of people in this movie. I've seen this twice now. I have a very weird relationship with Westerns. I don't necessarily like the ones that are like The Searchers, where it's just white people having to defeat Native Americans. I don't necessarily find that story particularly fascinating. Here, though, it's not really about the Native Americans. It's about this group of people. It probably explains why I really enjoy something like My Darling Clementine, too, which is really just about different levels of humanity more than anything else. But I've seen this twice now. I still really love it. This is a fantastic film with so much symbolism, and it's almost like the real world, 1939, when people stop being polite and start getting real in a stagecoach with Native Americans shooting arrows at them and babies being born. Hygiene and sepsis being a very real.
You bringing up the real world just made me the happiest woman in the planet. It's a really, really smart script. I know we're going to talk about the critical reception afterwards, but one of the things I love is how much Orson Welles loved this film and said he watched it 40 or 50 times in prepping for Citizen Kane. Stagecoach is an incredible script. It is this microcosm of white society. It has different socioeconomic backgrounds. The immediate difference of how the two women are treated is handled so well and has such a nice arc to it. And then the different men, it is one of those things, again, of talking about John Wayne and the choices he's making. This is someone who famously turned down High Noon, right? So him doing this film where he's not the villain, he's a bad guy of sorts. The reason he's with them is the marshal is out to get him for something else, and so they're taking him to lock up. Like, he's not there as the knight in shining armor. He's bad boy. Sam alluded. This is hands down the sexiest he's ever been. I always found him gross because when I started watching these, he was so much older. The movies I was watching, he was so much older than me. So I was like, ugh, gross old man. And now watching back as a slightly pervy old woman, it's like, yes. Hey, John Wayne, not bad. Too bad you got all John Wayne.
So fascinating that he plays a criminal. I was really amazed by that. I was looking at the cast and I just did not expect his name to be next to that character. But at the end of the day, he still, in his own little way, plays the hero, which it's a little bit of an embryo of what he would go on to play. Over time, he would throw the criminal aspect out the window.
For sure. This is why it's an interesting role, right? He gets to be the bad boy and the nice guy. He's the only one out of them who shows any grace towards Claire Trevor's character, the very well-kempt prostitute. For someone traveling by stagecoach across the American West, her eyelash and lipstick game is on point constantly.
I always noticed her hair, how well each little curl on top of her head was put together. So I completely agree with you there. And she still has the costume changes and the bustle and the satin. So of course she was done up, as in, I know, like, through history that prostitutes were really the only women who wore any kind of makeup back then. But I was still surprised to see her that put together after she's being kicked out of town and put onto this rough stagecoach with all these men.
As you know, I love Claire Trevor so much. She's one of the reasons that we did Murder My Sweet, because I love her and think she's incredible. But this is also a slight tweaking of that same thing, because she played bad girls so often, which is a testament to the depth that she has as an actor, that she has, that she looks like someone who's smart enough to be scheming and processing a lot of different things. And in Stagecoach, her character is someone who you meet and you can tell, like, oh, she's looked down upon by this society. Am I meant to hold her in judgment as well? And she fights back with it in a really vulnerable way. It's really interesting scripting, because normally there's not a defensiveness. She's completely accepting of how she's being treated. She just is hurt by it. And I thought that was a great way to enable sympathy for her character, which allows for her relationship with Mrs. Mallory, with the Louise Platt, to develop in a way that feels really meaningful. Because, of course, we realize midway through this journey that Mrs. Mallory is so anxious to find her husband and so distressed when she finds out he's been harmed. He's a member of this cavalry because she's very, very pregnant. You guys, I don't know if you know, it's the most woman of states you can find yourself in.
I love how well she hides it in this movie, too. She's got, like, a nice little convenient wrap around her shoulders, and you're not supposed to know that she's been 9 months pregnant this entire movie until a baby pops up.
Yeah, I could use that wrap. I would not turn down that wrap.
You brought up Claire Trevor, and I always thought, whether we're talking about this or Murder My Sweet or Key Largo, which is another great Claire Trevor movie, she always played a woman who had been ravaged by not necessarily time, but society's expectations of her. So like in Key Largo, she plays a woman who has become a drunk because of the abusive relationship that she's in. In Murder My Sweet, she's this cold-hearted woman, obviously because the implication is that she's been mistreated by men, so she's going to get one over on them. And here, it's that society is the one doing wrong by her. She is being kicked out of this town because they assume that she is, you could say she's a prostitute, a dance hall girl would have also had very similar connotations. And she tells one of the characters at the beginning of the movie, "Don't I have a right to live?" It's that idea that we want people to toe this moral line, but we don't want to better their circumstances, and we certainly don't want to condone them. It's so amazing to consider this is 1939, the code had already been implemented, and yet this movie still treats her as a human being. It doesn't ever condemn her for her actions, real or imagined, and at the end, she succeeds getting everything that a woman at that time period would want in terms of domesticity and happiness, which I really appreciated. Louise Platt, who plays Mrs. Mallory, it's so great to watch the scenes where they're interacting because they don't know each other before this. It's just the implication that she hears that maybe Dallas is a prostitute. That means she doesn't want to be her friend. When they're in the stagecoach and she's getting nauseous and Dallas says, "Well, do you want to sit next to me and you can put your head on my shoulder?" And she's like, "No, I'm good." It doesn't even matter that she doesn't know this woman. It's the fact that other people have told her that she is this type of person, and therefore we don't want to associate. When you have two women who are placed at such odds, and then you have all these other men who are various types of bad, but yet you still interact with them. John Carradine's character, Hatfield, is a man who feels that the Confederates should have won, and yet he still gets these moments of dashingness. He's still supposed to be this like charming guy. There's these shades of gray with the men, and yet Ford is really looking, and the script is really looking at how women don't have those luxuries.
I love how Claire Trevor is treated in this movie as well. My background with Claire Trevor isn't as extensive as you guys. I've really only seen her in movies like How to Murder Your Wife and Key Largo, where she plays women who are supposed to be well past their prime. So not only with John Wayne is this the youngest I've seen him in anything, but the same goes for Claire Trevor. She does a really excellent job here. Not only is she handling Louise Platt's character's pregnancy and delivery with Doc Boone, she is also the one who's really roping in John Wayne's character and trying to get him to escape, trying to save his life. So she's juggling a lot of things while she's going through her own personal issues. So I'm really happy that she gets a happy ending.
What makes the relationship that she has with John Wayne's Ringo so compelling is that, unlike Mrs. Mallory, she doesn't know Dallas at all. Ringo comes in the exact same way. He doesn't know anything about her, and he doesn't care. He doesn't treat her any differently. He's willing to offer her a chair. He's willing to be supportive for her. And even when there's grousing from other characters about the type of woman she is, he doesn't let that affect their relationship. She tries to tell him, you know, she has a past, he's not going to want to be with her, and he understands that none of these characters are good people necessarily. Everybody has issues. It makes for a really progressive relationship in 1939 that these two characters are able to see past their past and find some sort of relationship out of it.
I love it. And I feel like that's part of what makes John Wayne his criminal character. It makes us see the good in him through the way that he treats Dallas. He's such a gentleman to her. He's so kind, and he treats her equally as he treats Louise Platt's character. I think he puts them on the same playing field, although he's, of course, in love with Dallas, but that makes him really admirable to the audience.
Tied in with that, his handling of them is one of the most welcome parts of this, and it does garner so much sympathy for Ringo as well. But what's great is his character's not oblivious to whom Dallas is. He knows the kind of woman she is, the work she's been up to. That's pretty clear. There's no way this guy who's been riding the range enough that he's killing people and having family members be killed is clueless. He's probably visited a brothel or two. So I like that there's not a willful unknowingness about their backgrounds. It's just a calm acceptance. Like Kristen said, that in 1939, the almost progressive element of that, of these characters taking each other at face value. The other thing I really appreciated is he doesn't sexualize Dallas. He treats her well as a confidant and a traveling companion and someone he's drawn to. But I was actually very grateful that there wasn't a sexually charged energy between them, because it would have really undercut the battle for acceptance and just respect that she was putting out. And I thought that was a great decision. If it was John Ford's, if it was Wayne's, whatever it was, I was happy that they played it out that way.
This is a movie that is really a morality play. If you really look at the way that the characters are presented, what's unique about this is that Dallas is a prostitute, maybe. Ringo is an outlaw. You have Thomas Mitchell's character, Doc Boone, who is an alcoholic. And yet these characters understand the hardships of life, and they're still presented as sympathetic. You still root for them. Doc Boone is still able to deliver a baby, even though he has some personal flaws. He's still a good person. And then you contrast that with some of the other characters who put out this image of being good people. And Hatfield being a Confederate and a gambler. Gatewood, the banker.
That is my favorite detail of this film, is that at the end of it, the ultimate villain is this embezzling banker. Because that is the most urban of story points, the idea of a banker stealing money from his own bank, and that they've welded that into a Western and made him this very uppity, snooty. He's the one who keeps trying to enforce these social mores nonsense.
So poignant in 1939, as we're just slowly starting to climb out of the Depression, the fact that the banks had let people down. And so to have the ultimate villain being a banker had to be for Depression era audiences. Ironically, I watched this movie in a Depression giggles class, movies that were supposed to be looking at the Depression through more humorous eyes. That has to be intentional, that Gatewood is this villain who works at a bank, because it had to be an FU to audiences who understood what banks had done to them. And then you also have Donald Meek, who plays Samuel Peacock, who is a whiskey salesman. And so with Prohibition being over, it's almost like the script is saying, we've glorified money and we've glorified alcoholism, the roguish Prohibition era gangster. Well, in this time period, the Western background is almost saying, these characters were never meant to be glorified. You shouldn't be worshiping these things. You should be looking at the flaws within people and still be able to appreciate them as humans. It's so smart.
No, it's such a smart script. And I'm glad you're turning it into the talk of, because I really like the shape of the women's story, and was really grateful that there were two of them, that we got this idea of two women and they're being looked at in different ways because they're at different status levels. But the rest of this group is male, and it is such a fun and interesting array. Andy Devine is the one playing the babbling drunk driver, and George Bancroft plays the marshal, who is, you know, like the heart and soul. That's the character that John Wayne would want to play later on. I know that Sam would probably like to talk about John Carradine in general, so I would just like to chime in to agree this is my favorite thing that he's done, because he gets to be a total smoke show with these cheekbones to die for and this beautiful hair, but then he's also presented just very matter-of-factly as, yes, I'm a Confederate officer, and yet you're all still going to be attracted and respect me, which I found amazing. I kept waiting for the twist of that character, and the reveal was just like, no, he's still a smoke show.
It's always funny to me to look at John Carradine, because my TCM BFF, Keith Carradine, it's so weird to see the commonalities and how similar they sound and act. But no, you're totally right. John Carradine's character really harkens back, and it almost seems like the script is calling out these romanticized notions of villainy, that John Carradine's character is supposed to be this quintessential movie star, good-looking guy, the impeccable facial hair and being so dashing. And he's like, oh, Mrs. Mallory, how are you today?
Please enjoy my collapsible silver cup.
There's so much gentility in his persona. And yet at the same time, the movie keeps subtly reminding you, when he says the Confederacy, that this guy is racist. This guy probably owns slaves. It's almost like the audience is complicit. You knew these things were happening. You knew bankers were embezzling. You knew men were getting filthy rich off of whiskey selling. And you knew that there were racists, but you found them attractive. It almost is calling out the audience by saying, are these things acceptable? If we remove them from our current time and put this in this time, why are they acceptable or are they not?
I do have to say he is my favorite Carradine by far. I've seen a lot of his movies. I do think that it's really interesting that he was too good looking to be a real character actor, but he wasn't attractive enough to be a leading man. So he ended up more skewing towards the character actor side. He played a lot of really amazing and interesting, but really thankless roles. I was just watching Johnny Guitar as well, another really well put together Western. And he is barely in it, this amazing legend of an actor, but you see him, you notice him. And I think the same goes here. He plays a bigger part, but that's another interesting part of his characterization, because you're right, he is such a gentleman. I love the way that he treats Mrs. Mallory. I always thought that they were going to get together. Am I the only one?
Oh, yeah, no.
I thought that her husband was going to have mortal wounds and then he was going to come to her rescue.
I think that's how he wants to present himself. I would not put it past the Hatfield character to be like, hey there, lady, you should totally tell your husband where to stick it and hang out with me. He's that kind of guy that just wants to be hot to all women. I would not have blamed the movie for making her have a bigger choice.
Part of what I find really fascinating about his character, too, is exactly what you were saying, how he despises Doc Boone, but Doc Boone is a character that we're supposed to like. But he's also such a gentleman to Miss Mallory. It's like, I don't know what to do with him in this movie, and I don't know what he's going to do next. And I think for that reason, he was by far the character that caught my attention the most, and I just kept my eye on him, wondering what he was going to do.
Well, and I know we've touched on it a bit, but we haven't talked a lot about one of your favorite characters. I'm assuming in this movie has to be Thomas Mitchell.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He plays Doc Boone, and I do really enjoy Thomas Mitchell in a lot of movies. I've seen several movies with him. He tends to play characters that are either emotionally conflicted or have a very staunch moral code. Something like this in Out of the Fog, which is a very different role, but still has that sense of morality to it. He does play this very florid, highly educated person. He has a literary sense. He's misquoting Faust at one point. But at the same time, he is obviously a bit of a broken person. He's an alcoholic, and he gets this chance at redemption. That's something we haven't brought up yet, that all of these characters are going to a town called Lordsburg. They're all trying to wipe the slate clean or be redeemed in some way, and they believe that this new location is going to either provide a new start or a chance to close grievances that has to be explicated. But Thomas Mitchell is great in this movie. What do you think about him, Sam? I know you've actually been doing a lot of behind-the-scenes work where Thomas Mitchell is concerned.
In a similar way to John Carradine, but more so, he's just been that actor in the background of these movies that my heart always goes out to. If you're really looking for any movie where Thomas Mitchell really earns an Oscar and was not given one, watch Angels Over Broadway with Rita Hayworth and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. He pours his heart into that role. He brought a lot of himself into this part, and really all of his parts. One thing that a lot of people don't know about him is that he was a playwright. He was very invested in literature and the spoken word. And so he does quote a lot of literature in his roles. He also plays a lot of drunks. That was a very common theme for Thomas Mitchell, even though he actually had stopped drinking and went completely sober for 2 years before the production of Stagecoach, which I found really admirable that he would still go back to those kinds of roles after he put that in the past in real life. He earns his Oscar here, but it isn't much different from pretty much all of his other roles, which I actually consider a compliment, because if all of his performances were as good as the one that earned him an Oscar, that meant that he was a fantastic actor, which he was. I did some research on him, and I found out that he was in the basement of the Chapel of the Pines crematory. It really made me aware that there are so many classic film stars who have unmarked graves and have their remains in places where they're not supposed to be. And Thomas Mitchell was really the actor that I admired the most that was in this situation. So he's the one that inspired me to start trying to mark these stars' graves and to start getting these remains where they should be, where fans can admire them. And I'm still in the process of working on Thomas in particular, not to publicly out them, but Chapel is not very organized and they're still in the process of looking for him, so to speak. So it's going to take some weeks, but I'm really hoping that they find him and that we can give him the proper burial and treatment that he deserves, an actor of his caliber.
That's awesome. I'm so happy you're doing that.
Thank you. I really try to involve myself in every fashion in classic film, and that's one of really by far the most meaningful way that I've built a connection to these classic movie stars that I love so much. I mean, we just got Edmund Lowe a marker. I'm so excited about it. He was in Dinner at Eight and some other movies. It's not stopping there. Next, I'm really looking towards Disney. There are a lot of Disney people, Disney voice actors and such, who have unmarked graves, so I'm really working on that next. Hopefully we can get everybody out of that kind of situation.
Awesome. To transition back to John Wayne, there's no good transition. We're just going to do it.
He is also passed away.
Very, very true.
A very morbid transition.
Yes. Let's talk about John Wayne in 2019. We talked about it at the opening, but I want to talk about when he came back into the news earlier this year. It turns out that an interview that he had done in 1971, I don't know why all of a sudden it came back out in 2019. I know somebody had retweeted it and then it just took on a life of its own. John Wayne had done this interview where he talked about believing in white supremacy. He was really against the American way of life as he knew it to be at that time in the 70s, where there was this discussion of racism. He was opposed to the fact that there was more overt homosexuality coming out into cinema at the time Midnight Cowboy had been released. And he had some very unkind words to say about that film. A lot of his outrage was towards the fact that he didn't feel that he needed to deal with how African Americans felt they had been treated in society. And a lot of his views are just, I would say, not necessarily surprising if you know who John Wayne was. That's what surprised a lot of people, especially people of my generation. People don't read anymore, and there's only so much you can teach people about old Hollywood unless they're actually willing to do more outside of it. People were very, very surprised. They were very surprised. I do have the quote right here. He says, quote, "I don't believe in giving authority and positions of leadership and judgment to irresponsible people. We can't all of a sudden get down on our knees and turn everything over to the leadership of the blacks." So that was in 1971.
That quote actually ends with, "I believe in white supremacy until the blacks are educated to a point of responsibility," which I think is maybe the most repugnant element of it.
I got to throw out this other one, too. He says, quote, "I don't feel guilty about the fact that 5 or 10 generations ago, these people were slaves. Now, I'm not condoning slavery. It's just a fact of life, like the kid who gets infantile paralysis and has to wear braces so he can't play football with the rest of us." Okay, I'm not going to throw in your obvious comments about disability there, but really?
One of the things that's interesting, so this article came out in 1971 in Playboy, as you mentioned, with True Grit coming out in 69, the year of Woodstock. John Wayne was so the epitome of the old world that the young and the hippies were rebelling against. He was the man. He was literally the image you thought of. And in a lot of ways, like Kristen mentioned, it's maybe not that surprising if you're familiar with him that he said these things, but the contextual element of knowing the period of time, a very tumultuous point in American history, he was a perfect example of what we're seeing a lot of right now, which is this to the death grip holding on to a very specific perspective and viewpoint of what America is, what masculinity is, what the male role is, and what white America was, that holding on to it and refusing to let go or open a little or see from other perspectives. All of those statements are really closed off, but they're disguised as being benign. The "I don't mind," "Oh, how nice of you not to mind an entire race of people." As Kristen also mentioned, I love that I'm always like referring back to per Kristen's earlier email, the idea that this came out this year in a much broader way and it got on Twitter and spread. I feel if the culture had had access to, for good or bad, the internet, something that would have put this to a broader thing, I highly doubt people were sending random snail mail messages to each other with a cutout of this Playboy interview in it. So it wasn't part of a broader cultural moment the way that it was even just in the past year here when it got revived. Had it been that, had John Wayne had an entire mass, the younger people, the hippie movement, if the Black Panthers had been privy to this interview, I think it would have been a much larger conversation that could have been really interesting and helpful for the country to have had at that time. Unfortunately, you know, it's the conversation that we're having constantly now. So it's really a unique slice of history to see this thing out of history in a way.
What really evokes a few different reactions out of me about this interview is, number one, how late you could say this was. I mean, it's still in the middle of the civil rights movement, but these very polarizing statements seem like they belong a little bit before this. And another point, I know a lot about Hugh Hefner and his role in the media around this time. And while he was publishing these sorts of articles, he was also publishing Martin Luther King Jr.'s last words. That's really fascinating that he sort of chose to publish this right around that same time that he was promoting civil rights, and he was a huge activist for that cause. In a way, you could almost say that Hugh Hefner was outing John Wayne as a person who had these sorts of views. That my mind also goes towards Bob Hope and his views on Vietnam. That one surprised me more than John Wayne, because John Wayne is the epitome of masculinity and conservatism. Bob Hope, really, a lot of his really conservative views on the war in Vietnam weren't made public until this recent American Masters documentary's release. I'm surprised by all of these words coming out, all these true feelings. A part of me wishes that it would stop, because I know that a lot of the actors and actresses that I love have these views, and I don't want to hear it anymore, you know? I want to keep on continuing their work, and hearing all of these things makes it a little bit hard to do that.
It's worth pointing out, too, that John Wayne at this point in his life was really holding on to an aesthetic that, as Drea mentioned, was considered passé. He had just done Chisholm that same year that this came out. He was doing Big Jake, and then he'd do the Cowboys. I mean, he was really holding on to this white male manifest destiny type of movie that by 71, when we had real world concerns like Vietnam, like the civil rights movement, like the deaths of JFK and MLK, we had seen real horrors in modern society. But John Wayne was espousing things that were supposedly fixed, that were solved. And yet I can't help but assume that he was really speaking towards a group of people that really believed what he was saying was true. You have to look at how scary the hippie movement was to white suburban America at that time. The baby boomer generation who were going out and being like, get off my lawn, you hippie. And then the Sharon Tate stuff happens. I'm sure many of them genuinely believed that African Americans were asking for things that they didn't deserve, and movies were these smutty things that were glorifying homosexual sex and all of this. So I'm sure that he was talking to a group of people that did think like him, much like there is a group of people today that still think like him. But Sam, you brought up something that I think is relevant to this topic, which is, how do we reconcile cancel culture now with classic film stars? We've talked about John Wayne. You and I have talked about Jane Russell. How do we all come at a celebrity who has maybe been long dead and we're finding out horrible stuff about them? I mean, there's been people that we knew horrible stuff about, Errol Flynn and his penchants for younger
children.
Thank you. I was trying to figure out what that word was. How do we deal with that now in an era where we are supposed to completely disassociate?
My take on it, what I do is, if I don't like the actor in the first place, I take it more, I'm a little more receptive of that information. Comparing John Wayne to Jane Russell, for example, Jane Russell, I still think she was this beautiful, glamorous star. I love her work. I admire her. But after hearing those quotes, it's tough. It's really tough. I think John Wayne, on the other hand, he is someone that I didn't watch a whole lot in the first place. So hearing this stuff about him, which wasn't really even a surprise, hearing this stuff about him, it's easier to dismiss him.
Part of what you're saying is spot on, is that it's the presumption that he probably felt that way has maybe always been there, whether or not you had it confirmed by an actual garbage person quote. How I approach contemporary artists who are pulling things like these, like, I was someone who was always a huge Woody Allen fan. I loved his films. I do think he's a garbage person, but he's still making things that will probably never be released now. In a contemporary artist, I can vote with my box office dollars. I can say, I don't support your work. For instance, sorry people, I don't pay money to see Clint Eastwood movies anymore because I don't like him or what he represents, and that's a way that you get to vote in a capitalist society. With older artists, that's not really an option because you're either not renting, or maybe it is, like you're not going to buy those DVDs, but you'll watch it if it's on TV. It's a mixture of things, but I do think how we consume art, especially for people like us who take it seriously, and I think everyone should, but that's just me. I'm sure other people think I should also take vegetables seriously, and I do not. But I take art seriously, and I take film seriously, and the more knowledge you have about the people who are making things, the intent behind them, I think that all goes into contextualizing a film beyond just, oh, it really made me laugh. Analyzing things is a great human skill to be able to take information and synthesize it and get something out of it. This is what elevates us. Be the best human you can be. Arm yourself with knowledge. These are all bumper sticker slogans, you guys. Let's just print these out.
The real question for me and the thing that I struggle with is hearing something unsavory about someone that I love, someone whose work I appreciate, someone who I already admire. How do you guys deal with that? That's something that I would like to know, because I know that William Powell was a conservative, Anne Blythe was a conservative, and they're right up there. I mean, I haven't heard any direct quotes on them in particular, but I'm just citing some examples. How do you react? How do you process and deal with that?
When it comes to politics and a classic film star, I always just treat it like my Nana. Come from a different time, they don't understand. And I'm able to mitigate it that way. When it comes to hearing something like Jane Russell's comments on abortion, I always say, well, it's a hot button topic. Everybody has their opinion. I disagree with it, but it never factors into her performances. She never made an unplanned. She never made a movie that was strictly about her views. So, I mean, I might be a bit hypocritical when I say I can separate art from the artist on that level. If it's something like a person doing something horrible, like Errol Flynn being a child lover, or the fact that Friedrich March probably was part of the KKK when he was in college. As you mentioned, Sam, you don't already like them. I'm able to just enjoy their movies and be like, yeah, this movie's good, but you do know that Friedrich March was a white supremacist, right? It does color a lot of how I see them as a person, but for some reason, it never diminishes their movies for me. Woody Allen, I think, is a unique case because he always seems to talk about the things that he is into in his films. I find it hard to disassociate when his movies are so clearly about his love for children that I'm just like, how are we all not seeing this here? Is it just me? Has the world gone mad? But I think with classic films, because the studio forced them into making movies and said, you don't have politics, you don't have a religious preference, you are here to make a movie. It's very weird. I think the studio system almost helped them avoid cancel culture because they weren't able to make those mistakes unless they really, really wanted to. So by 71, John Wayne is able to make those statements because there's not a studio telling him, keep your mouth shut and just toe the line. You want everybody to love you. Don't say anything that's going to be inflammatory. We don't have that now. It's like the Wild West. Everybody's just able to do and say what they want. You either buy into it or you don't.
John Wayne was existing in 71 to balance out the Jane Fonda on the spectrum. So that was everything that was happening at the end of Studio Times. And also Manhattan, rewatching Manhattan now, which I would not. When I say the synthesizing of things, to answer Sam's question, it's an idea of what level of disagreement do I have with them? I'm related to many conservative people. And with the time difference and what a conservative party meant then versus now, there are plenty of things like, fine, live your life. To have your own beliefs. I'm not going to begrudge people that. It's when they become a point of actively either saying or working towards elements that I think are negative or harmful. Then I can be like, no, I don't watch those movies anymore. I'm not into that. There's a lot of movies out there. There's many things to choose from. I have not run into an element of an artist I really love discovering something and being like, oh no, because it would be hard. But the other thing that comes with this and why I think it's important for people to think further and why analysis is so great, we are a country that loves celebrity. And we love celebrity in this very big, whitewashed way where humans become archetypes, like we said earlier. And John Wayne's a perfect example of that. And if you are holding people up to that kind of level, you're not doing them any favors as humans or even as artists. And dismounting on the John Wayne of it, he is someone who built an incredible career, has legions of fans, built a film legacy, and did it in a very myopic way. He played one very similar kind of character over and over and over again, and that character also transferred into his personal life. And I don't think that's a great way for people to live or an artist. So I'm bummed out how his politics shaped his life. He's not bummed out. He has a whole airport named after him. So what does he care what I think? Also, he has left our great mortal coil, so he definitely doesn't care.
John Wayne now has become such an archetype, and there are still people in this society that hold him up as an example of kinder, simpler times. That times were better. Men were men when John Wayne was king. If you really look at John Wayne's movies, he played the same character that never really had anything to do other than be a man. What makes his movies so analytical, and the fact that we can talk about something like Stagecoach for nearly an hour, is that there was more to him in this movie than I think in some of his later movies. You look at John Wayne now in 2019 through the lens of how other characters react to him in the movies he's made. At least when I watch The Searchers, I don't look at John Wayne through the character of Ethan that he plays in that movie. I look at how other characters, like Jeffrey Hunter's character, reacts to him, or Natalie Wood's character reacts to him. As we become more and more removed from the times in which these movies are made, that's something that we say about all classic films. When we talk about, oh, how long until a movie is considered a classic? As we get further and further away from these movies' release dates, our thoughts on everything changes societally. Certain things no longer are acceptable. That's just the nature of progress, hopefully. John Wayne's definition of masculinity might have worked for a certain group of white, cis, able-bodied men in the 60s and 70s, but now in 2019, that's just become a concept of masculinity that is now out of date. I want to be clear, we are not saying that you cannot love John Wayne or his movies. What we're all saying is that all of these actors and all of their films are indicative of their time period.
Stagecoach is such an interesting discussion point because it's so different from the John Wayne who made those comments. This is by far the most complex character of Wayne's. He's one of the most sympathetic characters of Wayne's. He would play a white knight in some of these other movies, but he wasn't always someone that we could really support. Like in True Grit, he's very much on one end of the spectrum, whereas Stagecoach, he's such a gray area.
Well, it was a great one to talk about him through because it did have such a positive energy to it. I think if we had talked about The Searchers, we would be pulling our hair out. But now we get to have all of the good stuff of Stagecoach to balance out everything else.
See, I tried to make this episode a happy one. All in agreement, Stagecoach is really good. It's on Criterion. You can go watch it, go buy it. It's worth it. With John Wayne as a human, it's a bit stickier, but it should be. We should be able to revisit these people and look at them through a more progressive lens and look at ourselves as people. Before we close things out, I want to make sure that my co-hosts get a chance to talk about what's coming out on their personal projects. Sam, what's going on with your writing and where can fans find and get in touch with you?
I am blogging at musingsoftheclassicfilmaddict.com, and you can find my Cooking with the Stars posts exclusively at classicmoviehub.com, and you can follow me on Twitter, find out all my thoughts about movies and all of that good stuff at classicfilmgeek.
Drea Clark, where can fans find and get in touch with you? Any projects you want to promote, feel free.
Yep, I am still working heavily with Who Shot You podcast, and you can listen to that for more contemporary film talk. I am on Twitter at the Drea Clark.
Of course, you can find me on Twitter at Yearnies_film. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com. We're on Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, help us out. Leave a rating and a review. And we are now on Spotify and SoundCloud. You can always contact us with questions, comments, suggestions directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, gmail.com. And you can visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, which is journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. If you want to hear exclusive content before anyone else, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. We have a wealth of amazing perks. All your donations go right back into the show. Patrons now can get episodes 48 hours in advance, as well as a bevy of pins. We're trying to come up with some more merch. We're also going to be putting on a classic movie night. Because of all of our amazing patron support, we're going to be watching a Doris Day film together. You can find out more about how we're going to do that and get involved by heading over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. I also have my two bonus shows coming up. William Bibbiani and I talk about how Hollywood talks about itself with Based on a True Podcast, and Adam Katzer and I do doubled features. We are going to be recording some new episodes shortly. Those are only going to be available on Patreon. If you want to learn more about the stars turning 100 in 2019, we aren't talking about them on the show, but if you're a member of TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long series about the stars spotlighted there. This month, I'm talking about Robert Stack. I'm going to actually let Drea tell us what we're doing next week because she suggested it.
Hey, Kristen, I'm very happy to tell you what we're talking about next time. It is a film by Akira Kurosawa called Ikuru. And I'm very, very excited.
I'm very scared because I've never heard of this movie until you brought it up.
Wait, for real?
I'm a terrible Kurosawa fan. I have seen one movie and it's not this one.
I can say the same. I only just saw Rashomon like last year.
I didn't even see that one yet.
Well, are you guys in for a treat? Because this is a beautifully executed, very, very bleak story. Woohoo!
Yay! So if you thought that this episode was full of happiness and light, next time's going to be even better. I'm excited to branch out of my comfort zone a little bit.
And you're going to find out the meaning of life. Come on, that's great.
It's not 42.
Thanks for all the fish.
That will be next time. Till then.